Hi, this is James Mercer from The Shins.
This is Shirley Manson.
This is Lo Tullist, co-founder of The Cure.
This is Huey Lewis giving you the story behind the song.
The Story Behind the Song is back with an exciting second season. We peel back the layers on music's most iconic hits with legendary artists like The Killers, Heart, The B-52s, Violent Femmes, Jewel, Huey Lewis, Modern English, and more. To keep the music flowing, we'll be sprinkling in classic episodes from our archives between each new one. So check out The Story Behind the Song wherever you get your podcast.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hi, this is Lo Tullist, co-founder of The Cure, and now I have a band with Budgie and Jack Knopfley, and you're listening to The Story Behind the Song on Consequence.
Welcome, listeners, to The Story Behind the Song. I'm your host, Peter Chotti of Deep Cuts Media. The Cure is one of the most iconic bands of the last 50 years. Formed in 1978, the group created a look and sound that many called goth. But when asked how they would describe the type of music they made, the band simply would say, "We play Cure music." Whatever you call it, the band sold over 30 million albums and still tour today. And just in time for the 30th anniversary reissue of their great live album, Paris, I revisit my interview with Lal Tolhurst, the band's original drummer, keyboardist, and co-founder with frontman Robert Smith, about their classic breakout song, Boys Don't Cry, from their debut album of the same name. So take a listen as we dive deep into the story behind the song Boys Don't Cry with Lal Tolhurst of The Cure. How would you describe The Cure's music, particularly during the times you were there?
Okay. I'm not going to be funny, but I'm going to tell you something that Robert always used to say when we were asked that question in the very, very beginning of our career.
Yeah.
You know, like in the late 70s, early 80s, we'd always be some hapless European journalist who would go, "Well, what do you call your music?" And Robert would always say, "We call it Cure music. That's what we call it." Because, you know,
I like that.
Let me be honest. It's everything. There's everything in it. You know, it's everything we ever listened to. A few months ago, my son, well, no, actually, it's a bit longer than that, about a year or so ago, my son sent me a copy of his first album as a test pressing. And he said, "Dad, would you listen to it so that I tell me if there's anything wrong on it, you know, with the," because he's never mastered a record before. So I went, "Sure, thank you." And then I panicked because, like most middle-aged dads, I don't have a turntable. I didn't have a turntable. You know, I mean, everything I listened to was on the phone or on CDs. So I went out and I bought a turntable and I had a listen and I said, "Yeah, sounds great." And then I found this box of old teenage records in the corner of my garage. And I thought, "I'm going to listen to those while I work on something." And I listened to them and I was absolutely amazed because everything that was The Cure was in that box. And just like the strangest connections. But when you listen to it all those years later, I could go, "Oh, that's where we got this from. And that's where we, you know, found this." So I agree with a good friend of mine, James Murphy from LCD Sound System. He said, when you start making music, you copy the people that you love. You know, you decide, okay, I'm going to make a song like them. And the way that you get it wrong, because you never make a song like the people that you admire, you can't, you know, it's impossible. You don't know how they did it. So when you make a version of that, the way you get it wrong becomes your sound. And that was really true with The Cure. We would listen to stuff and we go, "Okay, well, we don't want to do that and we don't want to do this, but this sounds okay." And we do our kind of version of it. And the way we got it wrong became The Cure.
So as you looked in the box and you had all those different sounds and you go, "I see that. I can see that in our music. I can see that."
Yeah.
Can you even pinpoint any major influences then at the time when you started the band?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, you have to remember the time that we grew up, the sort of mid to late 70s was when we started making music. There wasn't much going on except disco and prog rock. So take your pick. There's stuff from all of that in there. I mean, we listened to a lot of stuff like, you know, sort of early krautrock like Can and Harmonia and Cluster. And we also listen to things like David Bowie, you know, like if you think 1977, the two pivotal albums to me at that in that year, one of them will surprise most people because they don't think that it came out at this time, but there was Clash's first album, which everybody knows came out then. There was also David Bowie's Low came out in 1977. And that was very different for the time and taught me a lot of how to present yourself, you know, how things could sound.
Yeah. Well, get into a lot of different things, as I said. You have a new book, which is called, it's a great, great name, Goth, A History. Want to get into that, of course. You have a new album that's coming out, Los Angeles, with the drummer of Susie and the Banshees, Budgie, and then Garrett Jackknife Lee. So you have the... you know, this trio that's coming out with new music. And I'll ask you about that because one of the lines I love when I was reading about it is that it was described as a 55-minute electronic head fuck. Yeah. And I thought that was great. There are so many great songs that you wrote and co-wrote with Robert and others in the band.
Yeah.
And so it was very difficult to pick one. But Boys Don't Cry seems like, first of all, it's a great song. It's funny because when I was looking at Spotify this morning, Boys Don't Cry was the number one listed. You know how it identifies what's playing the most.
I try my hardest not to look at Spotify because I have some serious problems with it. But yes, you're right. It's the one that people listen to the most. Yeah.
Which is pretty interesting because there's so many great songs. But first I want to get into just a little bit of the story of you and the band and you and Robert, because my understanding is that you met when you were 5 years old and went to school together. So just take me through just, you know, briefly a little bit of a journey of you and Robert and how you formed the band and the evolution of the different names of the band. I know there were a lot of people who were coming and going, but you two stayed constant.
Yeah. Well, you know, Robert, when I was a very little boy, like one of my earliest memories, Robert used to live next door to my grandmother with his parents, right? And I would see him in the backyard playing, you know, and like all little boys, I'm like, oh, there's another one of me. We didn't really, you know, make any contact then, but the first day of school, we got on the bus because we were both Catholic. And that meant, you know, in England that you have to go probably to another town to find a school because there are not many Catholic schools. So we got on the bus together and we went to Catholic school. And then, you know, like most kids, we hung out a little bit, but we didn't really sort of start doing things together until we were about, I suppose, like middle school, 11 and you know, 12. And we started to think about music because that's when you generally kind of, as a teenager, you start to discover music and stuff you like. And we had a class together where we would be in the library studying, and we got talking, and I'm like, yeah, so I like this guy, Jimi Hendrix, you know, I have a big poster of him on my wall. And he's like, yeah, me too. He said, my brother's got all his records. Do you want to come around and have a listen and stuff? And I'm like, sure. But then, you know, we would start to rehearse what we thought we could play in the school music room, like lunchtime, you know. Robert would bring his, I'm not sure what the equivalent is here, but like a sort of $20 Woolworths guitar that he had, and we'd plug it into the stereo system, and then I would raid the music cupboard and find whatever things I could use to hit. And we'd play that, and we'd, you know, we'd try to make something that seemed reasonable. And so, you know, that's really where the whole thing started. And then gradually, as we got older, you know, we could start to hang out with each other. And Robert's parents were pivotal because they remodeled their house, and they built a sort of extension that they were going to use for like Christmas and parties and things. And we just moved in, you know, we just like that. Okay, I'll put my drums in there. We'll put the amps in there. And for 3 years, from like 16 to 19, that's where we were. You know, I don't know if you've read Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers. He says the difference between, you know, it's like 10,000 hours, right? So that's where we put our 10,000 hours in there. I mean, not on purpose, you know, for us, it was a social thing, which is, I'll talk to you later about the new album, how it was so similar to the way we started playing music. But we would just sit there like 3 days a week, just chat, talk, play records, and then say, well, look, I've got this thing. Just can you do something with it? And, you know, maybe it'd be a little riff that Robert had, or maybe it'd be a beat or an idea or a name for something, you know, and we just go from there.
So the parents were supportive of the fact that you took over this new part of the house and
they were banging around in there. Until it came, you know, like Christmas time and stuff, we had to get out and go to the local church hall. But both Robert's parents were always very supportive of what he did and what we did, which was great, you know?
Yeah, I know that there were a couple different iterations before you became the trio that became The Cure, but one of the iterations was first The Easy Cure based on, and tell me about that and the evolution from The Easy Cure, which was one of the names, and then that evolved into The Cure.
Well, we used to do sort of like trilogies of songs, you know, because we couldn't really figure how to go from one, you know, part of a song to another part. So we do like three sections and we call them individual songs. So like three songs. So we had one that I'd written some words for, and it said something like, I need an easy cure. And what we did was we couldn't decide the name of the band. So we thought, we'd read that Bowie had cut up all his words and put them together and sang them. And so we thought, well, what we'll do is we'll cut up all the words, we'll put them in a hat, and we'll pick out something. And whatever we pick out, that's the name. Right. So we picked out Easy Cure and we were like, all right, okay, we'll use that. And we used it. And then we were sort of thinking, well, you know, about a year later, all this punk stuff was happening. And we're like, well, that sounds a little bit too sort of hippie-ish and stuff, you know. Let's just call it The something. So we call it The Cure. Okay, great, fine. So that's how it stuck. It was a combination of purposeful thought and happy accidents, like most things, you know?
Yeah. That's amazing, because I do, you know, I've interviewed so many great artists and there's so much serendipity that comes with with the evolution and success and resonating with the audience out there. And I had no idea that that's how the name evolved, that it was putting something in a hat and picking it out, which became The Cure, which is such a classic name in music, you know, history.
Yeah, and it works. And I mean, you know, but whoever thinks names work, I'm sure when they sat down and said, well, what would we call our band? Pink Floyd? And everybody was like, what's that mean? You know, what's a Pink Floyd? Can you eat a Floyd, or is it something you grow? You know, I'm sure those conversations went on. But over time, you know, you get attached to that name, and also people attach what it is. And it turned out to be very, very fortuitous to call ourselves that, really, in lots of ways. Yeah.
Yeah. So when you started, and then we're going to dig into the song, but when you, this was now late 70s, and there were the three of you, you were with you and Robert and then Michael Dempsey on bass, right? The three of you.
Yeah.
And you were going into the studio for the first time to record your debut album. Was there already the name, was goth a thing that you were thinking of at all?
No. I mean, you know, the first album was basically a live set, like most bands. I mean, there's that old saying, right, in the music business, you know, you have your whole life to make your first album, right, and then 6 months to make number two, right, which is pretty much how it went for us, right? And it goes for most bands. So the first album, we walked in and we're like, okay, these are the songs that we play live. And as a young band, you know, you get very used to, if you pay your dues, which I'm sure a lot of people still do, if you go out and you play to people, you know, everybody's played to the pub on a Sunday night with five people in who don't care. Who really don't care what you play or don't play, you know, you're probably just, you know, a loud sound over there talking. So you have to find a way to grab their attention and you have to find a way to keep your spirit up. So songs changed in time with that. But the basis of what we would always like was like the more melancholy, you know. So even on the first album, there's a couple of songs that are in that that vein. Now, nobody called it goth because it wasn't goth yet. I mean, you know, there are signposts. I mean, I talk extensively about this in my book because, you know, a lot of people bristle at the thought that The Cure might be called a goth band. And they say, oh, no, it wasn't goth. It wasn't goth. And I see that point of view, you know, that it's true in lots of ways. But the opposite's also true because we were like the fertile ground that came from. You know, nothing, maybe I go out on a limb and say that it wouldn't have happened quite the way it happened if it hadn't have been for us and a few other people that I name in the book. It's like that's the place where it came from. And nobody, I don't care what band you are, nobody goes, okay, it's January the 1st, 1977. We're going to make punk music now. And that's what it's going to be called. That's what everybody's going to call it. And they're going to love it. Right. I mean, I remember going to see The Clash and Suicide were opening for them, right, from New York. And Suicide called themselves punk years before, you know, like we're like this New York punk music, you know. And nobody kind of took it up, but it took some time for it all to coalesce, you know. And Suicide didn't sound anything like The Clash either. But, you know, good, you know, idea from Strummer and co to spot where the connections are. You know, I always like that about The Clash, that they always brought people on tour that they could see the connections. This is where we're going, and this is where some of this comes from, you know. It's very true. It's very true.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned The Clash, and in some ways it's analogous that The Clash is, I would say, enigmatic, like the word I use for you, meaning from my perspective that very different kinds of music. But you said, like, you liked the melancholic when you started, but then the sound alternated and frequently on the same album from melancholic, a little bit dark, to very upbeat and fun and all that. And The Clash, of course, would do their more like punk, and then they would have a reggae song or something like that.
Yeah,
and
it was, but, you know, it's all to do as well with where you find yourself in place and time, because it's no, you know, I know it sometimes to people that didn't grow up in London or around it's like seems strange that they would do a reggae song. But if you grew up in London at that time, reggae and punk were like the two predominant forms because they were both youth music, you know, and you couldn't escape. You could not escape reggae if you lived in West London, for instance, you know, because it was coming out of the walls left, right and center. There was lots of, you know, blues places and stuff. And so people, you play what you hear. You play what you hear and what you know, and that's how it works. And then
you make it your own.
Then you make it your own and you reinvent it. And that's what's been happening ever since, you know, Gene Vincent and Elvis, you know, for sure.
Yeah. And then just quickly before I dig into the song, well, so what does, because it's the name of your book, we've talked about a little bit. What does goth mean then to you?
Goth is not really a subculture. People sort of think of it. A good friend of mine, Kathy Unsworth, who's a journalist in England, she's written a book about it as well. And she also said to me the other day, because I did a book event in London with her, she said, you know, it's really good that you actually came out and called it goth and said, yes, this is what it is. Because she said, a lot of times, she said, people avoid it because the mainstream press sort of tries to defang the music by calling it that. Because, like, if you can go, okay, well, it's about bats and coffins and graveyards, you know, you could do, like, exactly what you just did. It's a smile comes to your face and people go, oh, well, it's not that serious then, and we can ignore it, you know, or we could just sort of pull it by. But actually, it's very serious. You know, I spent 40 years going around North America. I can walk into any small town anywhere in America, and, you know, if I spend an afternoon there and go to the coffee shop or whatever, I can spot the 5 or 10 kids who are going to be goth, even if they don't know it yet, you know, themselves.
Yeah,
you know? It's like, because it's a way of being, it's a way of life. It's more a way of looking at the world. It's a philosophy. It's not a fashion. You know, the fashion comes with it, but that's not the main part about it. And the music as well. You know, there's lots of different types of music I would think would have that influence, you know, from something like Kate Bush with Wuthering Heights, which is very goth.
For sure.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to start a podcast with another friend of mine a while back, a few years ago, and we were going to have this section that we would call Goth or Not Goth. And so we bring up people.
I love it.
Right, we bring up people. It wasn't my idea. It was my friend's idea. I have to tell him that. We brought up this thing. We go, okay, we'd name two people. So we'd go, okay, Michael Jackson, probably goth, right? He was pretty goth, right? Lionel Richie, not goth at all, you know.
Interesting.
So, you know, you can pick out the elements, and that's what I'm looking at. I'm looking at the elements that make up things. You know, I mean, there would be no, you know, and I'm sure, you know, you'll get a lot of letters about this, or what people get nowadays, email. Billie Eilish, there'd be no Billie Eilish without goth. You know, that's part of it. That's its manifestation later on. But I think it was all the things that we were listening to, all the types of music. It was also all the things we were reading, which doesn't affect a lot of music intentionally. You know, it affects it unintentionally, but for us it was very much part of it. We wanted to be, you know, a lot of late 70s or mid 70s rock music was very certain and brigadocious, and, you know, like, hey, I feel like making love, and we are the champions. You know, it's like, it's very on the outside and
external,
you know. And for us, a lot of what we were thinking about was internal, and we wanted to express that. And that requires some vulnerability, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Going into the studio now, the three of you.
Yeah.
You called your debut album
it's got
Three Imaginary
Titles. Yeah, right.
Yeah, there were two titles, one in the UK and then Boys Don't Cry in the US.
Right.
Three Imaginary Boys, and that was the debut name in the UK.
Yeah.
Why imaginary?
I had a dream about it was actually about Robert's garden, and there were people walking around the garden late at night, and they were like ghostly, but not, and it was obvious to me it was us, and it was so there's three of us, and but it was in my imagination, so that's Imaginary Boys, because that's the simple answer for it. The other thing to me is it speaks to what I was talking about certainty, you know, like a lot of rock music beforehand was very certain in where it was going, what it was doing, and what you had to get from it, and for us nothing was certain. Nothing was obvious. We were trying to find out what we felt and how we felt it. So to be imaginary was actually probably, you know, the only way we could really describe ourselves at the time.
Were you pretty certain about the songs that you selected for the first album?
Like I said, the first album was really our live set for the previous, you know, couple of years or whatever. So yes and no, because, you know, when we got in the studio, I know, you know, there's some other thoughts about this, but we were, you know, in as much as we had some professional knowledge, we'd been in a studio before, we understood what went on. We didn't really have, obviously, we didn't have the idea of how you make an album. You know, it's like, it's the same thing as writing a book. Once you've done it, you get the idea, you know what you have to do. But the first time you do it, it's terrifying, you know, because you know, you look down and you go, okay, I got to write 80 to 100,000 words, and they've all got to join together. Oh my God, how do you do that? Same with an album. You know, you've got to make a whole thing that's going to, as it was then, two sides of vinyl. It's got to make sense, and it's got to sound good, and it's got to sound cohesive. So we had Mike Hedges, who was really only, you know, a few years older than us, but seemed like this very wise older man, you know, because everybody does when you're 20, you know. And
right,
yeah, he's probably in his mid-20s, you know. So, and Chris Parry, who had taken us on, you know, and it's good credit to him that he actually saw who we were and thought, okay, this can, you know, it might take a little time, but this could be really good. And So we sat in the studio with him, and in as much as we had some knowledge of what's going on, how to get to that point wasn't really our forte. So we kind of, you know, we said, okay, you show us where you're going to go. And we didn't assert ourselves as much as we would for the second album. So the first album is an amount, I mean, you know, for the first album, we didn't really have much of a choice about what the cover looked like or anything. It was like presented to us like, okay, this is your cover. And we're like, oh, okay, maybe that's what you do.
Since you were playing essentially a live set on the first album, you wrote the song well before that, this particular song.
Right.
But was there much shaping by him in the production of your sound, or did he, or was it in their minds, the production's minds, that this is the sound, this is great? Like, how did you, was there a lot of that kind of guidance?
Chris Parry was a drummer in a previous life, you know, and I always say, you know, a little tongue-in-cheek, but it's not really. It's kind of true. You know, all drummers are friends, right? It's like the Freemasons. If you're in it, you know, you're in it, right? And so, you know, he had a great affinity for the drums, so he liked the drums. So he made sure that I had a really good drums set to play. Actually, it belonged to Rick Butler from The Jam, because they had been there and they'd got some new equipment, and he persuaded them, because he had signed them to Polydor beforehand, and he said, well, you know, would you let my boy borrow your kit, because it's a lot better sounding than the crap that he has, you know? And I'm like, yeah, that sounds great. So I got to use Rick Butler's great drum kit. And then, you know, there's a three piece, so there's a great deal of space. I think probably the one thing that we did have input in is to make it sound spacious, you know, because we liked things to be empty. And like the drummer in Cannes, Jackie Leibitz, would say, you know, you have to play monotonous. So we liked things that just evolve slowly. But, you know, in the first album, it doesn't work quite like that, because there's other influences coming on and other pressures. You know, you've got to make an album that's going to make a splash. And the easy way to do that is to write something that's catchy and you know, what people would call an earworm nowadays, but it gets into you.
Yeah.
We had actually started a song like Boys Don't Cry. Michael has a very good remembrance about that, but I'll bring that up later, because it makes more sense when I tell the story of how we came about that song.
No, well, let's talk about that. It's the perfect time to talk about that song, and give me the journey of the song from the very initial spark of it.
You know, we had heard bands like Buzzcocks and loved the fact that they were writing songs that were punky, but were also, like, you know, great pop songs, you know, and pop songs wasn't a bad word to us. You know, we like some pop songs. You know, we'd grown up on things like T-Rex and you know, Bowie and bands like that, and glam rock, and so we heard all those things. You know, when we were going to do it, I think it was that the Queen of England had an anniversary. I think it was 1977, right? And we were going to play this festival, because lots of people had festivals for things like that, and so we were going to play this festival. It was a very small festival, and we had rehearsed either the night before or that afternoon, and Robert had presented us with what became the bassist for Boys Don't Cry. And we're like, Michael said, yeah, he thought it was great, because it was like, it had something, it had a different feeling, and it was powerful. It was a pop song, but it was a powerful pop song. And so we played that in rehearsal, and then we went to play at the festival. That shows you know how dedicated we were. We, like, in the morning, we got up in the morning, rehearsed, and then went to this festival with like maybe 50 people at the most, you know, lolling about on the grass, and that was it. And we played it, and people kind of reacted a little bit to it, and we thought, okay, that's a good direction to go in, you know, that's something positive. Wasn't the first single that came out for us, but it was indicative of what we could do. Write something that's plaintive but catchy. That was a good sign for us. So that's really how Boys Don't Cry came about.
So Robert presented something to you that was the basis of it. Does that mean that was the melody and the lyrics, or some initial lyrics?
No, I don't really recall. I think it was probably both at the time. sometimes, you know, a lot of things, a lot of songs that we did at the time, which is why, you know, we tried to employ this way of working with the album I've just made with Budgie and Jack Knife Lee. It's like music's, the problem comes with bands after about the second or third album, and everybody gets these roles set in their mind because they're like, okay, this has worked, this didn't work, this is what I do, that's what you do. So, you know, you come to record something and everybody has their stations and everybody knows what they're going to do. And, you know, that's fine, but that can become very boring after a while because, I think, you know, music is the only art form that people are expected to kind of recreate what they did before, but in a different version. So it's, you know, familiar but different, you know, and that's a real conundrum, you know. I mean, you don't expect, you know, a portrait painter to paint the same portrait every time, you know. It's like, you know, it's not Mona Lisa times 100, you know, it's like something different. So we were very against doing things that way. So I think initially we would all throw in ideas, you know. So it's like, for instance, A Forest, I thought of the title, Robert wrote the words, you know.
Great song.
Thank you. So, you know, different things come from stuff. And songs were never made in the same way. You know, sometimes one of us would come up with a little riff or a beat or a lyric, and we would go from there. Over the years, though, you know, things start to get streamlined, read boring, and everybody goes, especially when you get bigger and everybody, you know, you don't need to get everybody together to record. So you sit at home in your own home studio, make up stuff that you think the others would like and send it to them. And then you have a big meeting where you go, okay, this one, that one, no. And then you work on those things, which creates, you know, a whole set of other problems about stuff. So I don't know, at the beginning, you know, it's naivety because we, you know, also didn't really know what, I mean, this goes against what I just said, but it's like we didn't know each other's strengths either, you know, what we do best for each other and with each other. And so you have to explore it. So that was probably the first time when that sort of minimalism of musical input came with a nice sense of melody, because there's a lot of melody in there, but there's excitement because it's a little punky and it's a little, you know, the rhythm of it is like that. But it's also, you know, it's like, and I don't equate this with the Beatles, but, you know, most of the Beatles' best songs have something that's very familiar. You know, you go, oh, okay, and you latch in straight away. And then there's a little twist, and then there's something. And at the very end, there's another little twist, and you go, whoa, wasn't expecting that. And that excites. I was reading a review of my book, and it said, you know, humans, something I'm paraphrasing here, it said, like, humans crave difference and certainty, you know. And it's true, you know. You want to know that, like, you know, I listen to songs sometimes, and I probably annoy my wife. I say, okay, I know exactly where I've never heard this song before, but I know where they're going to break and where this fill's going to go on the drums and what they're going to do here, because it follows a pattern, you know, and I know the pattern.
Yeah.
It's ingrained in my head, so I could play it without even knowing the people. Sit down. It's funny. I'll tell you a funny story. I did a charity event, which I tend to do each year, which provides musical instruments for kids who don't have the wherewithal for musical instruments. So we raise money for that. And it was last weekend. And the organizer called me up and he said, I want to put together like a little cover band to play for this particular section of the show. And he said, do you think you could do it? Would you like to do it? I said, yeah, I play drums. I can do that. He went, okay. So he said, I've got the other guy that's going to do it with you, Moby. So I went, okay, I don't know Moby personally. I think I've met him once, but I don't know him personally. What songs are we going to play? And it's like, I'm not sure yet. It wasn't until we got on stage and Moby turned around to me and said, can you play this? And I'm like, I think so. Just, you know, give me a nod when you want to stop. And so I start, you know, I can play songs that I don't know because I know them. You know,
yeah,
I know.
That's quite a weekend treat, by the way, in Los Angeles, where all of a sudden you're at this little event and it was probably not small, but not huge.
No.
You have Lal Tolhurst of The Cure and other points, obviously. And then you have Moby on stage just whipping up a live set for
benefactor's dinner or something like that. I can't remember what it was.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was just fun, you know.
Yeah, good for you. We're going to take another quick break, and then we'll be right back and get into your new projects. And then I want to touch a little bit about the transformation of the sound. Interestingly, one of the things I read before I take the break was that Robert actually was unhappy with your first album, I don't know if that's true or not true, but that's interesting. But anyhow, I'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Lal Tolhurst of The Cure. You were the original drummer, co-founder of the band.
Yeah.
And then your style, I mean, sadly, we don't have time to get into it too much, but there was a reinvention of sorts. I don't know if that's right, but you moved from the drums to the keyboard. And just very quickly, how did that happen? Why did that happen? Why did you want to do that?
Well, mostly it was force of circumstance, because we had finished our fourth album, which was very intense. And we went on tour, and the tour was very intense. And, you know, the band effectively broke up at the end of that tour, you know. So I decamped to France, went to work with some French bands and, you know, produced an album, two albums, I think, with different bands. And then I got a phone call from Robert because, you know, at that point, like I say, the band had broken up. I didn't think we were going to carry on. And Robert called me up and said, I'm thinking of going into the studio. Would you like to come along? And I went, yeah, sure. So that's when it was just two of us. And I'm like, okay, right now everybody's using drum machines. You know, I think like it was like Soft Cell, different people. Everybody's using different stuff. It was exciting. You know, it was like, hey, this is a new thing we can do. So I said to Robert, well, why don't we, you know, we'll get some kind of machine or whatever, and then I'll go into these new keyboards and stuff, which seemed very exciting. You know, like there was the idea of sampling and stuff. Nobody had thought of that before. And we were like, except on tape, you know, and we were like, okay, we can use something like this and it'd be exciting. And also, you know, for me as well, I thought, okay, you know, I like being the drummer, but I also want to be out front a bit, you know, because I'm a performer, you know. I often tell people, you know, I get on stage, my heart rate goes down. I'm not, you know, it's like I'm more comfortable
interesting
there, you know. It's maybe a bit psychopathic, I'm not sure, but like my heart rate, it's I'm calm up there.
It works.
Yeah, you know, I'm calm, it doesn't matter, you know. It's like when I'm there, I'm comfortable, I know what I'm doing. So I wanted to be out front a bit more, and it just seemed like a good thing to do. So that's really, you know, like circumstance became the master of that particular idea, and then we just ran with it further forward. I mean, you know, I love both sets of things. I do both sets of things still. I think, you know, drums are my first loves in lots of ways, but, you know, also if I look at it, writing is my first love. You know, like Pearl Thompson, who was in the band several times and at the very beginning as well, he said to me a little while back, he said, you've always been a writer since I've known you. And he knew me since I dated his sister when I was 15 or something, you know. So you
as a community, we already knew each other.
Well, it was very incestuous in that way. You know, I mean, you know, the whole thing is, you know, if you live in a small town, you're going to know everybody. I mean, in our small town, there was only one other band, and it was run by Neil Gaiman, the author, the famous author, right? And I read an article recently where he said, you know, or this may have been in my dream, but I'm pretty certain I read it. He said, the only other band in our town was The Cure. So we stopped, you know, which I thought was
that's funny.
Magnanimous. Yeah. But also, you know, he obviously went on to do some great things. So, you know.
Well, very good. So we talked a little bit about the integration, the formation of the band. And that was in the late 70s. And then disintegration of the band in 1989 when the album Disintegration.
Yeah.
So Lal, just tell me a little bit about that, about the circumstances of you two were best friends you were mates from the very beginning. You started everything.
Yeah.
It was your musical journey. You know, you co-wrote everything together. Like you said, there were just two of you when you kind of moved from the drums to the keyboard.
Right.
So tell me about Disintegration.
You know, the whole thing is a very slowly happening car wreck, really, you know, because like most bands, it's like as it gets, you know, most bands don't last longer than about 10 years, you know, but if you do, then things start to happen, you know, and we'd been going for a long time. All the usual, you know, culprits came in, you know, there's too much drinking, there's too much partying, there's too much everything, and it all goes on. And at a certain point, I realized that for me, my ability to do the things that I really loved was getting damaged by, you know, my mental situation, my mental health, really, which is something I've become ever since then, like a great advocate for that in music. You know, I went to do a thing with a friend of mine, Dr. Christine Guptill, up in Toronto, because she had some conferences about this particular thing for musicians and artists working and how things, you know, get affected. And she's doing a lot of great work about it. So, but anyway, back then I fell prey to all of that. And I think, you know, for Disintegration, even though, you know, there was some input from me, there wasn't enough, certainly wasn't enough for my own satisfaction, certainly wasn't enough for anybody else's satisfaction. And it was a very traumatic, trying experience. When I think about it now, it's still that way. But I've come to terms with it ever since, because it's been a long time ago. And, you know, I got healthy. I got clean and sober. I've been that way for a very long time. And so that's really the long and the short of it. So Disintegration was actually a very true title. You know, that's what was happening for me.
Yeah.
But also it was happening a bit for the band overall. If you look at it, it's like, it's never just one person, one situation. There's always things going on that drive stuff into a different place. The thing about The Cure is, you know, it's like family for me. I know what's going to happen. The day I die, I know my obituary. You know, I know what it's going to say. It's obvious, you know. But Robert's the person I've known the longest my whole life now, because my parents have passed away. I've known him 60 years. So it's like family. Like family, it goes up and down. You know, family's waves. You know, people are not always, you know, exactly the same with each other they were their whole life. It changes. So that's really the story of The Cure.
I remember at the time, because my friends and I were huge Cure fans.
Yeah.
And I remember on Disintegration, there was a lot of buzz about, okay, Disintegration, does that mean the band is, you know, this is the last album and all that? And it is a very dark album. It was kind of a bringing back the dark after some uplifting, you know, an era that had much kind of a different alternative sound and going to that. So very interesting that it's not surprising that there's that kind of darkness at that time.
Yeah.
But let's segue a little bit into, because I want to get into some rapid fire questions with you too.
Oh, okay.
But your new projects.
Yeah.
Goth A History.
Yeah.
And we already talked a little bit about what goth means to you. And then your new album, Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And that's, as I said, described as an electronic head fuck.
Yeah.
Interesting. You already mentioned James Murphy of LCD. And he's actually a vocalist on, and then you have, you know, a lot of different musicians, The Edge from U2. But tell me a little bit about those two projects, why the time was right for you to, I know you're a writer and you've written other books and you've written so many songs, but why now for Goth A History and why now Los Angeles with Budgie of Susie and the Banshees and Garrett Jackknife?
Well, a lot of that happened because, you know, me and Budgie have been friends since 1979. You know, he was playing with Susie and the Banshees, and so we became friends on that tour. So a few years ago, a friend of mine said, oh, an old friend of yours is coming to town with John Grant. He's playing with John Grant, and I'm going to do an interview for him. And I went, oh, good, I'll come along and meet him, you know, because I haven't seen him for a few years. I want to say hi.
Yeah.
And so we went for breakfast one morning downtown LA, and I walked in and it was me and Budgie and Kevin Haskins from Bauhaus had come. And, you know, I know Kevin's a little bit then. I know him much better now. And we were all sitting there and I said, you know, we should do something because, you know, we're all getting up there a bit older and stuff. We should do something. Now's the time. So instead of the three tenors, how about the three drummers, you know? So we,
I love it.
So, you know, we thought, okay, great, fine. So Budgie finished the tour, came back to Los Angeles, and we piled all this noise-making stuff in my car, and we went up the coast to this little remote village and overlooking the ocean, and we sat there for a week, and we made noise, and we thought, okay, this is really good. We could do something. And then I called up another drummer friend of mine, which is going to surprise you because you would never guess this in a million years, but Tommy Lee, right, from Motley Crue, right?
Yeah, of course.
He has a great studio. And I met Tommy way back in the 80s because we were all on the same circuit, you know, Motley Crue, The Cure, and Madonna. I never met Madonna, but I would come back in the evening and maybe the Crue had played there the night before or were going to play there the next night. And I'd see Tommy.
That would be quite a double billing, by the way, The Cure and Motley Crue.
Yeah, I don't know if it would be great, but the drummers would get on. But we were like sitting there. We'd always sit in the bar and talk, and he would tell me about his thing that went upside down with him playing drums on and stuff. And I knew he had the great studio in LA, so I called him up and I said, hey, Tommy, we need, you know, a studio. Can we come to your studio? And he said, yeah, I'll give you the bro rate. You know, he said, don't bring any drums, though, he said, because he said, I have a shitload of drums. And I got there, and he was right. He's got this huge warehouse-type room full of drums and nothing else, right? So we made this album, me, Kevin, Budgie, and we asked Danny Lohner from Nine Inch Nails to come along and help produce it. And at the end of a few weeks, we'd got this album, which sounded like you would imagine an album from a guy from The Cure, a guy from The Banshees, a guy from Nine Inch Nails, and a guy from Bauhaus would sound like, you know? And we didn't like it. We were like, no, this sounds too much like where we came from. This is not the future. This is the past, you know?
Interesting.
And at that point, fate intervened, as it always does with music, right? Kevin had to go because Bauhaus had started this big reunion tour, so he had to go and play it back with Bauhaus. So Kevin went to play with Bauhaus, and it was just me and Budgie left. And I kind of knew Garrett, you know, from like socially, you know. So one day I went up to this festival in Topanga and I met him, and we were listening to Willie Nelson's Sons Band, which, you know, I'm not really a country guy, as you get, but they were great. They were like punk country. I mean, they're brilliant, you know. And John Densmore from the Doors introduced them, which was, you know, pretty interesting. And so we just sat down and talked for hours, and I said, oh, look, I've got this album. Can I bring it to you and see what you think of it? And he went, yeah. And I brought the album up to him, and we had a listen, and 3 or 4 hours going through talking about it all. He says, why don't we just rip it up and start again? Why don't we just start again, just to, you know, get Budgie to come back to LA, and we'll record another album. And that's what we did, you know. And I walked outside. I called Budgie up. I said, I found our guy. And I was probably crying, you know, because it was like, it was very emotional. So that whole thing started. We did most.
Was it very emotional because you felt, yes, this is different. This is something unique.
Yeah. It felt, because I realized talking to Jackknife that this was the missing part. This was the part that we needed that was going to make it work. And, you know, plus, you know, Jackknife has one of the best studios I've ever been in. It's like an Aladdin's cave. It has every synth known to man in one room and every bit of drum stuff in the other room. So, you know, it's like, it was perfect for us. And it's right out, you know, in the middle of the canyon, in the middle of nowhere. You'd never find it if you didn't know where it was. So it was very peaceful, but very creative, because every day we would go up there, you know, it's about half an hour from my house. We'd go up there, we'd have a cup of coffee, and we'd sit and listen to records, because Jackknife has about a bazillion records, and he collects, you know, like 10 albums come every day to his door, you know. And he's like, so we listen.
Vinyl.
And we listened to vinyl, and we'd start talking about it. And then he'd go, oh, okay, I've got one of those, and have another listen, something. All music from all over the place. So do that for an hour or so, getting to know each other, because you're like, you know, I knew Budgie. I also knew Jackknife, but the pair of them didn't really know each other. It's the role I've been in a lot of my life. You know, I get people to talk together and get the connections. So anyway, we talked, we got got going. And then we would say, okay, let's go make some music. And we just wander into the studio and start playing stuff. Sometimes I had maybe like a loop that I'd worked on and I said, let's try this as a start. And, you know, we throw that in. Sometimes nothing.
Yeah.
You know, we just go and play. And so it was very organic and very natural way to do things. So we go home, come back the next day, and Jack Knife would go, I've been playing around with these things, have a listen. And he'd press the button and made this beautiful music out of the nonsense that we've been playing. Well, not nonsense, but you know what I mean. Just like very,
yeah, of course,
very uncontrolled stuff. And he had trammeled it into something worthwhile. And we go like, okay, well, let's add that to it and let's do this. And you know, then you've got the template on which to work. And we did all that. We finished the whole album because we were going to go an instrumental album. Just the day that the whole world shut down with the pandemic, we had finished all the music. And we were like, oh, okay. So I dropped Budgie off at the airport and said, okay, see you sometime, you know, whenever this is all over. And during that, we thought, okay, originally we wanted to be like an instrumental album. And we, you know, like you see those old krautrock albums where they have like, you know, Mobius, Rodelius, and Eno, you know, all on one album. We thought, okay, we're going to, that's where we got the titles from and stuff. And we thought, okay, well, I know James Murphy. Let's send him a track or two, see if he thinks he could do something. And Budgie knew Bobby Gillespie. So we were like, okay. And Jackknife knew The Edge because, you know, he's worked with U2 a lot and he lives like, you know, on the next hillside. So they're all from Ireland as well. So they all know each other. So
very cool.
So that's how it all got together. And over the couple of years of the, you know, the hardest part of the pandemic, you know, some people came to his studio, some people, you know, they just send things in remotely. And it worked. And we started to see a pattern of what it's going to be like. And, so it became very exciting to us. And, you know, it kept the faith up. It's funny because back in the day when you made an album, it used to take months and months for the album to come out because you're printing vinyl and stuff, and it still does. But, you know, there was always that moment, like, you know, almost a year later after you'd finished it, where the world hears your work and you get these people going, wow, this is, you know, whatever. I don't understand why you've done that. But it's an exciting moment. And we've got that coming up. And I'm, next week or two. So I'm looking forward to that. Because I'm so used to these songs, you know. I know I'm backward fronts, you know, in my dreams, you know. But the world doesn't. So I'm happy for that to happen.
No, congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, congratulations on that. And the book, too. And
yeah.
I look forward to definitely listening to the music, but also reading the book. Like, the book to me is going to be very fascinating also.
Well,
and I know that's going
to be a great start already. I went to London a couple of weeks ago and then New York and did a thing over here. I've had a great reception so far, and it's like people really love it, which is very heartwarming to me.
Well, like you said at the very beginning, goth is a state of mind, you know, it's a way of being. It's not, and so it's always there.
Yeah.
It presents itself in different forms, but I know this, I have a Christmas gift coming for my daughter
and
it's a book that we're talking about.
Okay.
So.
Good.
Okay. So, and, really quickly, I want to get into a couple rapid fire questions before we wrap it up.
Yeah.
So what's your favorite Cure song?
If I like one song that I would play to somebody that didn't know us at all, I would say I would pick Cold off of Pornography, just because I love the way it lurches in and it's just got a power. But I also, you know, I like other songs like Just Like Heaven. I think, you know, it's a great pop song as well. And
it's a great song.
So, you know, there's too many, really. I mean, I know that sounds pompous.
Well, there are so many.
Yeah.
Well, there are so many iconic songs from The Cure and that you co-wrote. And then as you listen today, just what are some artists that speak to you that you believe are breaking new ground?
Good. It's funny. A lot of people my age will come up to me conspiratorially and say, oh, there's no good music nowadays. You know, it all happened back. And they'd say, no, you're wrong. You just don't know where to look anymore. You've forgotten how to find it. But, you know, I have a son who's in a band, Topographies, and he's like, you know, 31, and the bands that he likes, you know, like Boy Harsher and you know.
I was going to ask you about Boy Harsher. Yeah, Boy Harsher is a great band.
Yeah. So, you know, he, you know, I didn't find them by myself. You know, I call him up. I go, Gray, what should Dad be listening to? You know, clue me in. And he goes, yeah, okay, this one, maybe we should go and see this one.
In the inevitable biopic of The Cure, who would you want to play Ulal?
Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, he'd only have to play me later on because earlier, you know, he's a little younger than me, but not much.
Well, that was fascinating. There's so many more things I'd like to ask you, but I really appreciate the time. It's a fascinating journey. It's great music. The journey continues with your new book and your new album, which is great. So everybody who's out there, check it all out. Thanks for joining me on The Story Behind the Song.
Thank you, Peter. I've enjoyed it very much.
That was Ulal Tolhurst, co-founder, songwriter, original drummer, and later keyboardist of legendary band The Cure, sharing his story about the band's breakout track, Boys Don't Cry. The Cure just reissued its 30th anniversary edition of their great live album, Paris, so go out and check it out. I'm your host, Peter Chatti. Reach out to me at peter@deepcutsmedia.com with your feedback about the show and ideas of which artists you would like me to interview next. For more of The Story Behind the Song, make sure you like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And tune in each week to hear more. And make sure you're following the Consequence Podcast Network to hear all of our great podcasts and to keep up to date with all series at consequence.net/consequence-podcast-network. And as always, thanks for listening to The Story Behind the Song.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.